This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner filling in for Lucy May. Lawmakers in Columbus have been all over the place this week. Feral pigs, recreational marijuana, property tax relief, and $350 million in one-time funding for all kinds of projects like the Cincinnati Convention Center. Closer to home, Cincinnati reached a deal this week after suing an out-of-town landlord, and we have a finalized city budget. Plus, if you haven't checked out WVXU's new podcast, Backed Up, what are you even doing with your life? We'll flush out the details. Then we'll talk about the hottest giveaway in town this week, an Ely De La Cruz bobblehead. Kicking off our Friday news review is Sarah Donaldson, our newest reporter and member of our excellent team at the Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So excited. All right, let's start with a topic that has people all over the state groaning and worrying: property taxes, specifically some pretty hefty increases for some folks. So, Sarah, start us off. Give us a recap about why property taxes have jumped for a lot of people.
So folks are seeing increases of up to 30% in some places, lawmakers say. And, you know, that means that it's a very easy way to feel an effect of state policies, which is why lawmakers are looking at a lot of different fixes for the increases. The biggest thing this week was that Republican representatives Beth Leer and Scott Wiggum, they're proposing limiting increases in property taxes to 4% per year. So they're putting a cap on those under that policy. They want this to be on the ballot, so it's right in front of voters in the fall. But I should say that it's pretty unlikely that it makes the ballot in the fall. So right now, the situation is folks are seeing really high increases. That's what they're complaining about. But it's not super likely that anything comes out of the state house in the next couple of months, at least in my opinion.
Okay. And how are they formatting it? Is it a bill? Is it a constitutional amendment?
Sure. So we've there are a couple of bills floating around. There's a lot of different ideas, but this policy in specific that Leer and Wiggum introduced, what they want is a ballot initiative. So it's like we've seen with a lot of other policies in the last year or two, you know, when you think back to abortion, potentially gerrymandering in the fall, this would be something that goes directly in front of voters, and it would be an amendment to the Constitution, because you can put something on the ballot statewide in two different ways. There can be everyday folks who go around and gather signatures on a petition, and they petition to get it on the ballot. But lawmakers also have the opportunity to put something on the ballot. And to get it on the ballot, 3/4 of the Ohio legislature would need to vote by August 7th to put this property tax 4% cap on the ballot. But you've already heard some opposition from Democrats. Democratic Representative Casey Weinstein told us that it's too one-size-fits-all. He feels like it's a sledgehammer to local governments, and he'd rather see the legislature expand the homestead tax exemption beyond what was already done in the budget last year. So, you know, lawmakers are hearing a lot about folks being frustrated with property taxes being high, but I don't think this is something that will be on the ballot in the fall. And even Representative Wiggum admitted he doesn't think it's something that's going to be on the ballot in the fall, just because it's not something that I think the whole legislature is going to coalesce around in the next 2 months.
Well, then what kind of timeline are we maybe looking at for some sort of proposal like this?
I don't know that anything will get done this year. The legislature runs on a 2-year cycle, and they're in the second year. So this summer is going to be much more focused on elections than legislating. And although there are a lot of ideas out there right now about what to do with property taxes, they're just ideas right now. Mm. There's nothing that's been fast-tracked. There's nothing that is moving really quickly with a lot of steam. So I don't know that there's going to be anything done in this year, I would say. So when you're looking that far, it's tough to give you obviously a timeline beyond the end of the year when the legislature closes out. But I would say I'd be pretty surprised if something substantive was done by December when they leave. And then once the legislature ends at the end of December, they have to start over with all bills in January. So it would be, you know, there may be those ideas that are around right now that pick steam back up in January or next year, but I don't think anything really moves this year.
So is this sort of like a performative thing? Like they're hearing all of this frustration from their the people in their areas. And so they're kind of trying it, but if they don't think it's going anywhere, but you know what I'm getting?
It's tough to say. I mean, you know, it sometimes can be election year promises. We want to do something with property taxes. We know it's something that constituents are reaching out about. But sometimes it is also just about getting those ideas out there. So a lot of the things that you're going to hear lawmakers proposing in the next couple of months, they probably know that it's not going to get done this year unless it's something that's really caught maybe the attention of the governor or the leaders of the chambers. But they're getting it out there so that maybe they can bring it back next year and someone says, oh, I remember that proposal from last year. Let's work on that this year because we've got more time this year. So I guess it could be in one sense a little bit performative, but Representative Wiggum, he said, you know, this is just getting this idea out here now so we can start considering it and start working through, you know, maybe some of the things that need to be thought about if this is something that we were going to implement.
Okay. All right. Let's turn from property taxes to marijuana. Applications are now open for outlets to request recreational marijuana dispensary licenses. So we're what, about a week or so into that process being open? How's it going?
It sounds like it's going really well. I talked with Representative Jamie Callender this week, and he is on a joint agency rule review committee. So he works a lot with the state agencies, including the Division of Cannabis Control, which is overseeing the program. This is actually much faster than we initially thought licenses were going to, or license applications were going to be opened. At one time, the thought was, oh, well, applications will open in the fall. But dispensaries, to my understanding, could be getting the okay to start selling recreational marijuana within the next week. Really, the next few days to the next few weeks, you're probably going to see some dispensaries starting to get licenses. And I should clarify, the only dispensaries that can apply for licenses right now are existing medical marijuana dispensaries, because that's what lawmakers have said is kind of the quickest process to, well, I shouldn't say lawmakers, this is what regulators have said sure. is the quickest process to beginning sale of marijuana, because medical marijuana dispensaries already have the infrastructure to sell. They're already set up. I mean, it's basically flipping a switch and checking, yeah, you're okay to sell to recreational customers as well as medical customers. So I've heard that once the applications opened up last Friday, it should be a pretty quick process to actually get that license. I was texting with a dispensary owner a couple of days ago, and he said they were all kind of, you know, placing like kind of fun bets on what day they think day one is going to be, because there's a lot of excitement. But sale really should be starting here pretty soon at those existing medical dispensaries.
Okay. And but it seems like a lot of like the legislation around this isn't quite settled, right? There's still some dispute over how much home growing should be allowed. And you mentioned Republican Representative Jamie Callender. He has some concerns over provisions that would limit home grow. We have some sound from him.
We have fought for and have maintained and will maintain the right for home grow without being registered. Without being licensed, what you grow in your house was voted on by the people.
And what's kind of the issue here that he's talking about?
Yeah, so there's been back and forth going on since, I would say, December, which is when issue two, that's what Ohio voters passed to make recreational marijuana legal. There's been dispute in the legislature and between the two chambers about how to change portions of issue two, which is the existing marijuana law. Nothing has made it to the governor's desk yet. And Governor Mike DeWine has been asking lawmakers to make some changes. Some of the big areas include the tax structure, public smoking bans, because right now, to my understanding, the public smoking ban on tobacco does not technically extend to marijuana.
Oh,
so lawmakers
okay.
want to close. And I'd have to triple check that, but it's been something that's talked about. They want to codify that specific language that says, you know, marijuana smoke, public marijuana smoke is not okay.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of people discussing that. I think that's a question that a lot of Ohioans are asking each other, like, is that okay? So it is interesting. Go ahead and continue. Like, what's being discussed about that?
No, absolutely. And another big one is home grow. Different states that have legalized marijuana have taken different approaches to home grow. Under the current law, and this is what was passed in issue two, you are legally allowed, if you're 21 or older, to grow up to 6 plants per person or 12 plants per household. So if you've got more than one adult in a household, you're capped at 12 plants per household. The policies that have come out of the Senate have sought to limit home grow. And the Senate did pass a pretty big marijuana bill back in December that the House did nothing with. Callender has been a big negotiator in the House on marijuana policy, and he's been trying to get recreational marijuana legalized for a long time. He's a big advocate of recreational marijuana, but he basically said this week that he has been and the House have been slow rolling what is coming out of the Senate because they're not happy with some of these policies that are limiting home grow, that are, you know, maybe limiting THC limits or other sorts of ways to kind of make the laws more strict about recreational marijuana. And Representative Callender says he thinks there are some things that need to be done, but he thinks that the law should be more in line with issue two and what voters pass. So that's kind of the argument there. Okay. The bill in the Senate right now has that public smoking ban. And the last thing that lawmakers have kind of tied to this is also Delta 8 THC and other hemp derivatives. It's a very specific thing that I've come to understand. It's basically any cannabis product with less than 0.3% Delta 9 THC. So is not technically marijuana. So there's a loophole in federal law that allows places to sell this Delta 8 THC and all these other derivatives. You might see it at gas stations even. So okay. DeWine has asked lawmakers to close that loophole to make it so that, I mean, you can buy it at any age under current law right now. DeWine wants it to be at least 21. So Representative Callender said he really thinks that lawmakers need to do something about Delta 8 THC. So we may see some action on that if the chambers are in agreement on that.
All right. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I teased at the top of this segment some one-time spending for various projects that all seem to have a bit of a tourism angle. Where is this money coming from? The Ohio Senate approved $350 million, I believe. Where's it coming from? What kind of projects qualify?
Yeah, so the Senate's still debating the $350 million. Oh, okay. It's likely to get approved. It's $700 million total, $350 million for the House to decide on, $350 million for the Senate to decide on. The House has already passed its $350 million, and it comes from excess funding in a recent fiscal year. So there was basically leftover tax money that the House and Senate agreed in the budget last year. They said, well, we'll dole out that money to different capital improvement projects. So small counties, big counties, they're all getting their piece of the pie. Lawmakers, you know, kind of worked with their districts to hear about projects that might be deserving of funding. And the Senate came out with the money that it wants to allocate to different projects. So the big one in Cincinnati and Hamilton County is the Convention Center District development. The House is giving $22 million, and the Senate is pledging $24 million. So it's a total of $46 million, and that is by far the biggest investment that I've seen from any of these budget lines in this.
All right. And do we know when they're sending the check down here?
So the Senate's debating this week, and then I believe they're under they need to pass what's called the capital budget. So this is a smaller piece of what is typically the larger capital budget, which is not the operating budget. It's different. It's all right. These physical improvement projects. So they need to pass it by the end of June, I believe, and that's the plan. So I can't tell you when the check will actually be cut, but the bill should be on the governor's desk by the end of June.
All right, fair enough. From what some people might call pork projects to feral pigs, this is as close as we're getting to tanimals this week. The state says Ohio has a problem with wild hogs.
It's not Porky Pig. It's not the pigs you see at your fair. These are mean, wild, destructive animals.
That was State Representative Bob Peterson this week. I'm laughing, but apparently this is a serious issue. Sarah, please explain what is going on.
You and I kind of had the same reaction because I all week was like, I have to finally get around to covering this feral pig bill. And I listened to testimony and I was like, wow, this is kind of crazy. So Lawmakers are concerned about two Republican lawmakers, Representative Bob Peterson and Representative Don Jones. They brought this bill forward, and they're concerned about a problem that they're seeing in the South, and something that ODNR has also brought attention to, of feral pig populations. Pigs reproduce really quickly, so even a small, 14 pig population could just multiply very quickly. And lawmakers say, these aren't cute farm pigs. They are feral animals. They can carry really serious diseases. And they have the potential to really sicken the rest of the pig population. So that could cut into Ohio's pork production. They have the possibility of ruining crops. So it could really hurt farmers' livelihood. So right now it's just in, to my understanding, Ohio's southeastern counties. So Athens County, Gallia County, Scioto County, ODNR has a list, but they've been spotted in Ohio's southeast counties. I think in 2023, there was a population of about 100 feral pigs confirmed, but Texas, for example, has like hundreds of millions of dollars in its budget to mitigate feral pigs because they are wreaking like that much havoc on the economy and on crops and pig populations. And I mean, it's pretty rare in this day and age with, you've got a Republican supermajority in the legislature. You've got kind of two sparring Republican sides in the Ohio House. No one voted against this bill. This bill passed unanimously, and that does not happen very often. At least it has not happened very often in the near year that I've been here.
And so what happens now? You said, unanimous support, but what's the kind of status of the legislation at the moment?
Yeah, so it passed the House. It now heads over to the Ohio Senate, and it was a pretty quick process. Like, the bill was introduced earlier this spring. It's not like it's been sitting around for a while, so with that much support in the House, it may have a really good chance in the Senate, as long as the Senate president is willing to bring it up. So it'll have Senate committee hearings, and then if it's brought to the Senate floor, it needs to pass the Senate and then go to the governor to become law. And it does, just real quickly, it basically, the big line item in the policy is that property owners would be allowed to shoot and kill a feral pig on their property without a hunting license. They just have to notify the Division of Wildlife within 24 hours and like follow the rules and requirements to remove its carcass. So it's kind of just saying open season on feral pigs, basically.
And like in 10 seconds, can you eat these feral pigs? Like if they kill them, can they eat them?
I don't think it's smart because of the disease.
Oh, right.
I have to look into that, though. But because of the potential for disease, because Division of Wildlife would want to test these animals, to my understanding.
All right. Fair enough. We will leave it there. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Sarah Donaldson, reporter and producer at the Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau in Columbus. Coming up, the city of Cincinnati and Vinebrook Homes decide to play nice in court. And tying the knot in the sewers? We'll explain. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. The city of Cincinnati has reached a settlement agreement in a public nuisance lawsuit against an out-of-town landlord. While the attorneys were busy doing that, city council passed a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Here to tell us all about those stories and give us an update on the hottest new podcast in town is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks so much for making the long trek down the hallway to the studio.
Always happy to do it, Tana. Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to start with the budget. Cincinnati Council passed the next budget this week. The big headline, no deficit. Huzzah. Yep. All right. We keep hearing city finances are in trouble, though, so make it make sense, Becca.
Yeah, officials are kind of saying both things are true. So the city budget is still in trouble looking ahead to the next several years. But for now, they had kind of a very conservative budget in terms of how much city officials expected to come in revenue and exceeded those expectations, particularly in property tax revenue, which should come as no surprise to anyone considering how often we've talked about property tax increases or the revenue increases, at least. Also, income tax came in higher than expected. But the income tax in particular particular, Cincinnati relies on the income tax a lot more than most other cities in the country. It's kind of a uniquely Ohio problem, which means that, you know, when income taxes aren't increasing, that is kind of a big problem for the city budget. So city officials are saying that's still a huge concern moving forward or looking ahead to the next several years. So a big focus in this budget is economic development, trying to bring more people to the city to kind of bolster that income tax revenue source.
Okay. And so one way they said that was a big problem during COVID when everybody went and worked from home. And so they had some problems there. But and they got federal stimulus for that. So they still have some of that left over, right? What's happening with that?
That's right. So the city has had a budget deficit the last few years, but was able to use that federal stimulus from the American Rescue Plan Act to fill the deficit. Now there's not a deficit to fill, so they can spend it on other things. So basically, technically what the city is doing is they're putting that stimulus money in the general fund for revenue replacement and then taking the same amount out of the general fund to spend on one-time things. So as I said, economic development is a big focus of this. So some of these are recommendations from city manager Cheryl Long, some from the mayor, but looking at neighborhood business district improvements, a couple million there, looking at property development improvements, things like putting money towards the connected communities plan. Mm-hmm. So looking at properties along those transit routes where those zoning changes are taking effect and having money available for development corporations, especially community development corporations, to kind of acquire that property quickly. Other things, the kind of biggest one that stood out to me was $5 million set aside for Green Cincinnati Sustainability Initiative. So the city is bringing in lots of federal money through grants, but the city is also dedicating a pretty hefty amount, $5 million, for those Green Cincinnati plans.
Okay. One of the biggest chunks always in a budget is public safety. It's been top priority, especially for residents, for city officials. Tell us what the fire and police budgets look like.
Yeah. So as you said, these together make up about 59% of the general fund, mm-hmm. this budget. So it's the biggest portion of the general fund every year. What's interesting to me is that share of the general fund has been decreasing recently. So for example, the police budget has increased about 44% over the last 10 years. The fire budget has increased 65%. So that's gone up a little bit more. But the general fund has increased almost 60%, so faster than the police budget. So they're not necessarily growing at the same rate, which I think is pretty interesting. That said, this budget does include some planned cost of living increases for both police and fire. Those, of course, are negotiated by their union, so we don't know the exact amount yet. The budget has it kind of at a low 2% wage increase. Likely it's going to be higher than that. But this budget also includes new recruit classes for both police and fire.
Mm-hmm. Did city council make big changes to the budget that was recommended by the city manager and the mayor?
Did make some changes. The last few years without a budget deficit, council has kind of taken the approach of not necessarily taking anything out of the budget, but just adding to it using, you know, a little bit of reserve money, that kind of thing. This year, there were some changes. Council decided to make some line item changes, like taking some money out of the street rehabilitation fund, for example. They're using that, some of it for specific pedestrian safety and traffic calming projects that they prefer. Also putting some money towards stairway rehabilitation. So reopening some of the city stairways that have kind of been neglected. But again, some of that comes out of the street rehabilitation. That means filling potholes and repaving streets. Also that money I mentioned for the connected communities, kind of looking along those transit routes, it's about $860,000. That's something that council added to that budget. So that was a priority for them. The changes there were a little bit of a where kind of some of the contention came in on council. This was not a unanimous decision. Council made about $4 million in changes to the budget. A couple of opposition, one from Councilmember Jeff Kramerding, who said he felt like the city or the council should not have taken away some of the money for neighborhood business districts because he felt like that was a big priority that they should have done. But more so, he and fellow Councilmember Victoria Parks both said they felt like it was rushed this year. Not really a different schedule than normal. Council has to pass the budget by the end of June. So they did pass it about 2 weeks earlier than they had to. But it's pretty standard in my experience for council to pass it the third week of June. So they're kind of a little bit earlier than that. But Kramerding kind of said, we've kind of fallen into a habit of just approving some of the same things year over year, and the budget is the most important thing city council does, and we need to take it more seriously. So his hope is that in future years, the budget is a more robust process.
Okay, so it wasn't that he took exception to like a particular thing in there. He just said, in general, I don't feel like I've had enough time to look at the document.
Yeah, he did say specifically he did not like some of the changes moved out of the economic development piece of it. But for other council members, you know, their opinion was we're just kind of moving around these economic development priorities. So we're not saying we're not prioritizing that, but Kramerdink did take some exception to the what was taken out of for those changes. But yes, in general, he kind of just wants to. He said he read the budget several times. I believe him. he's known as the kind of budget guy on council, not the chair of the budget committee. But you know, he it's kind of a running joke that he reads budget documents before he goes to bed every night. So.
Oh my, that's some interesting city reading. All right, bedtime reading rather. The city, let's move on. The city settled a lawsuit this week with an institutional landlord called Vinebrook Homes. Okay, first of all, what is Vinebrook Homes? You know, how many, I assume they own apartments or whatever, how many?
Actually, single family homes is Vinebrook's thing. So this is what, Vinebrook is what we often refer to as an institutional landlord. So it's basically a large for-profit company. They own 734 single family homes in Cincinnati.
That seems like a lot.
It's a lot, but as of last year, it was, including that, more than 3,000 homes in Hamilton County overall. So that's just in Cincinnati. They actually own single-family homes in other Midwestern cities, including Omaha, St. Louis, I believe, elsewhere in Ohio as well. And, you know, kind of by definition, because they're in all these places, they're an out-of-town landlord. So lots of complaints from the city, obviously where they filed the lawsuit, about these out-of-town landlords not keeping these buildings up to code.
Okay, so what specifically were they suing about?
So the city filed the first lawsuit actually back in 2021 because they said Vinebrook had a bunch of, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars in past due fines and fees. That was settled. And then they sued again in January 2023 saying, you're violating the settlement of the first lawsuit, but then had a long list of other complaints in this other lawsuit. So basically, as you said at the beginning, their complaint was that their business practices are a public nuisance. So part of the complaints there being that the city says they target lower income neighborhoods to buy up a lot of single family properties at once, making up kind of a high percentage of that neighborhood. On some streets in West Price Hill, the city said Vinebrook had ownership rates as high as 20%. They own 20% of the homes on that street. They also said that Vinebrook routinely failed to renovate, repair, and maintain properties, that they would sometimes renovate properties without the proper building permits. They also said, it's a long list, I'm sorry. They also said that they declined to perform necessary property maintenance and repairs in occupied units. They also had things in their lease agreements that the city said. Some, they said, the violated city and state law. Others, they said, would discourage residents from seeking repairs. Like, for example, they would say that the tenant is responsible for all small cost repairs without really defining what that means. They also said, if you call for a repair and we come out and decide either there's not a repair necessary or you caused the damage, we'll charge you $75 just for making us come out and look at it. Another thing the city says is discouraging tenants from, you know, seeking a response for those. So those are some of the examples, but there are some other things as well. The city basically saying this is too much. They initially were asking a judge to put the whole company into receivership so that the Vinebrook would no longer be in control of the properties in Cincinnati.
All right. And so Vinebrook was like, okay, we see your lawsuit and we countersue. What did they say?
Yes, Vinebrook did have a counterclaim. That counterclaim was not filed until almost a year after the city's initial claim. So just want to clarify that. But the Vinebrook basically said, we have just as much right to operate property and rent out property in Cincinnati as anyone else. And the city is, they say, illegally discriminating against out-of-town landlords. Now, it's easy to find evidence of this. You know, we do hear officials, particularly the city manager and Mayor Aftab Pirval, saying that they're unhappy with negligent landlords. They often call out-of-town landlords specifically. Pirval in particular has name dropped Vinebrook and that lawsuit several times over the last year, year and a half, saying, you know, that the city is really trying to crack down on these out of town landlords. And Vinebrook is saying in their counterclaim, this is illegal. They shouldn't be allowed to discriminate against us. We should be treated the same as any other landowner that provides property for rent.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go on to that. The city has really sort of made it a priority to go after not just Vinebrook, but like all of these large out of town landlords for bad practices, right? Can you tell us a little bit about like what else the city's doing?
Yeah, so there are some more recent changes to rental inspections. So there is sort of a rental database in Cincinnati. If you rent out property, you're supposed to be part of this database so that the city can kind of keep track. And if this pilot program started about a year ago, I believe, in a few select neighborhoods. But the city basically started saying, if you are not compliant with some code enforcement orders, we're going to inspect the property more often than we do other properties as a way to kind of keep better track of that. And has filed lawsuits against several other landlords as well. Some single family, other, you mentioned apartments. Williamsburg Apartments is another example, right, where the city has looked for court action.
Okay. And then just sort of real briefly, what's do each side agree to in the settlement? What's the outcome?
Oh, well, briefly is tough, Tana. I'll do my best.
You're taking away from backed up talking.
So basically, you know, one main thing is that they agreed not to disparage each other. So we didn't get much comment after this settlement, but understandable in a settlement like this. The city agrees not to discriminate against Vinebrook and to have training with some city officials so that they know to treat Vinebrook the same as other property owners and rental providers. Vinebrook agrees to an even more rigorous inspection sort of schedule in which the city can inspect several properties, about 25% of their properties. And if they're not following, keeping things up to code, they can kind of increase those inspections even more. And the Vinebrook has agreed to remove several key things from their lease agreements with tenants, including that $75 fee I mentioned for coming out for a maintenance request and other things that the city said were either illegal or were you know, inappropriately discouraging residents from seeking action or getting remedy from their landlord.
All right. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I mentioned at the start of this conversation that you and producer Ella Rowan dropped a new episode of Backed Up this week. If folks haven't heard it yet, what's real briefly like the focus of episode two?
This is what makes Cincinnati unique from other cities with combined sewer systems. It's this really complicated political structure where there's a fight between the city and the county over who owns what, who's in charge of what. So this is a little bit of a drama heavy episode, which is makes for some fun listening. But again, this is really, you know, lots of cities have combined sewer systems and have those problems that we describe in the first episode. But this is really what sets Cincinnati apart from those other cities.
Okay. I just want everybody to know, I know it's radio, but Becca has the coolest nails. She always has cool nail polish, but she has painted them to match the Backed Up logo, which if you haven't
very
seen it.
Very poorly, but I did my best.
They look really awesome. You should go to our website to see what the logo looks like. And you'll find pictures of her nails, I think, like on TikTok and Instagram.
On Instagram, yeah.
On the socials. All right. So give us a sneak peek. What's coming up next week on episode three?
Episode three is my favorite episode. So you have to listen to the first two. We talk about the rain, which sounds, you know, not that exciting, but I promise it's just really, it's really good. I think it's a good focus on community and how people are coming together to try to solve these problems. So it's a really good listen. But you got to listen to the first two before you listen to number three, which comes out on Wednesday.
All right. I have been chatting with WVXU local government reporter and sewer investigator Becca Costello. Be sure to check up Backed Up wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much, Becca.
Thanks, Tana.
All right. Up next, baseball fans line up hours before the gates opened this week. What had them flocking to Great American Ballpark other than just the Reds? We will find out. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner in for Lucy May. All right, this is just my second time in the host seat here on Cincinnati Edition. And for the second time, we are talking sports. And yet again, it is still not about soccer, the only sport I understand. Thankfully, our awesome producers have rounded up someone who does know a lot about America's pastime. C. Trent Rosenkranz is senior baseball writer with The Athletic, and he is joining me now in the studio to explain what has been going on down at Great American Ballpark. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Actually, I did have soccer questions for you, but
I mean, we can just throw out baseball and go straight to soccer.
Like, because I'm super excited. Like, I've been wanting the NWSL here.
Yeah.
For years, I think we're a perfect market for it. I want to see it. I want it here now.
It sounds like it might be happening.
You know, I questioned when they started FC that they could get an MLS team, and so I learned not to you know, the world is a large place and there are many possibilities.
I will say I also thought that it was unlikely that FC Cincinnati would end up here. So I was also wrong. So we'll see. And of course, Rose Lavelle, who's, you know, the big Cincinnati person. We actually, I should point out, we do have a lot of other professional women's soccer players in the league that are from Cincinnati. But Rose seems to get the most
Well, she's on the national team.
Exactly.
So that's where we are. But yes.
Yep. All right.
Sorry, we could go off on this tangent for a while, but I know that's not why I was brought in.
Yep, right. All right, let's go back to baseball. The big social media story, let's get it out of the way first. A fan ran out onto the field this week, did a backflip, and he got tased by a Cincinnati police officer. How often does it happen? In soccer, we call this a pitch invader. How often does it happen that we have people, you know, on the field?
It's one of those things where it's not so uncommon that it's always a story, but it's not so common that it's a everyday problem.
Right.
You know, it's not uncommon, it's not unheard of, but it's not an everyday occurrence. And that is because, well, you know, that is actually a trespassing crime, and they do not want you on the field, and this person got on the field. And so it's one of those things that's not uncommon. They don't show it on TV for a reason, so as not to encourage. This one might have, if they had shown it on TV, discourage. But yeah, I think there are much larger discussions that we would need to have more preparation for. So it happened, and it has happened before.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned, obviously, it's trespassing, so that's bad. But why, you know, like, is this dangerous for players and things? When
it can be. I mean, like, you know, I think for a lot of people, they're not expecting it. And this fan went straight up to Tyler Freeman, who was the center fielder for the Guardians, and it is front, you know. But if he had come from the back, that's would really kind of, you're in a safe space, a space where you're not used to people. And then I learned this when I was talking to some of my younger colleagues, that they are not old enough to remember Monica Seles.
Oh, okay.
And Monica Seles, tennis player,
right,
in the 1990s, and a fan went on and stabbed her.
Yeah, crazy,
so
scary.
So yeah, so I think there are legitimate concerns, and really, the end of the day, we all went there to watch baseball, not watch someone run onto the field.
Right. Okay. What do players think of the shenanigans?
I think it is one of those things. In retrospect, they don't like it. Retrospect, it was an amusing moment, and they moved on and they forgot about it. And really, in that game, that was a thing. But then, not 3 minutes later, Blake Dunn gets hit in the head with 101-mile-per-hour fastball, and you're less worried about those things than, honestly, the life of your teammate. Now Blake Dunn
popped up, and
he was fine. And like, I even talked to him afterwards, and he said he never blacked out. None of these things. The helmet did its job, basically.
Do they have those same protocols in baseball that I know they have in like football and soccer?
Very similar, yes.
Okay.
Like, and so the athletic trainer went out, gave him all that. And like, you know, he was not put immediately in a concussion protocol. Like when they do have it, when they're in a concussion protocol, they do not speak to the media, and they're there. And we talked to Blake, and Blake was completely lucid. He went through the whole at bat. I'm not a doctor. Dr. Rose Francis, my sister. and so I'm not going to say he was all okay, but he did not. I've talked to people with concussions before, and I've had them. And so he seemed good. He was checked out, and then he was sent to the minors last night.
Oh.
So
yikes.
but you know, it was one of those things that he was lucky. And the helmet, it did its job. It withstood a fastball at 100, like from one of the hardest throwers in the game, 101.4 miles an hour.
That's insane.
It cracked the helmet, but that meant the helmet took.
Right. That's what it's designed to do.
That's what it's designed to do.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on.
We got some happy stuff. They won.
So they won. They haven't been having like really a stellar season, but they did have a sellout crowd this week.
Well, and they've won. Let's see. I mean, I could go. They won a seven game. They won seven in a row, then lost two, lost one. So, I mean, that's 8 out of 10, which is pretty good.
Eight out of 10 bad.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
Better than my batting average.
All right. Well, so then they're what, second in the NL?
In the division, actually, I didn't look at it this morning and see what everybody did last night. I probably should have, but it's one of those things that it's June, and they're in the thick of it.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the takeaway is the season's not lost. There's still plenty of time, and this weekend is a big one because
the Brewers are in town, right?
No, they are in Milwaukee.
Oh, they're in Milwaukee, but it's the Brewers who they're playing.
They are playing the Brewers who are in first place in the division, and have been one of the better teams in this division for a while. They've got some changes. Honestly, the National League is really not good.
Oh.
I think there's one good team right now, the Phillies, and even they just lost one of their best players. So everything's for the taking is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, so can the Reds win this weekend? Can we sweep them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they can. They won't. I mean, that's how it works. That's the thing with baseball is so much different than other sports is that early, I sometimes like compare it to football is like reviewing movies. It's a big event. 1 week, mm-hmm. you gear up for it. And then baseball is like a soap opera.
Oh, that's
it can seem very dramatic on every single day, but then a week later you totally forgot that somebody had amnesia, you know, and you had amnesia about the amnesia. And so like it is a much longer play and it takes some patience and that can be tough sometimes.
Okay. All right. The sellout though this week.
Yeah. Well, Ellie De La Cruz bobblehead was really what?
The obsession with free stuff, but like why bobbleheads? Why this bobblehead?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. Bobbleheads are fun. They're kind of nostalgic. They sit on your, I have them in my uh-huh. apartment.
Okay.
I have them on bookshelves and I like them. I think it is the nostalgia of baseball. And then you have new ones every time. Ellie De La Cruz is one of the most exciting players in baseball if you want to say excitement, history,
mm-hmm.
Quite honestly, he's a fantastic talent, a young player, and he's here in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And I think it also the City Connect uniforms, which have been a bit of polarizing around
really?
The league.
I like ours.
Is
that a hot take? Do people not like them?
No. And, I think nationally people don't like the Reds ones as much. I don't know if this story went up. We ranked them and I had the Reds as number 2 overall of all the 28 that have been announced and will be announced. And I think nationally my peers had them much more near the middle. But I love them. And what I said was like, I think this city has really embraced it. It's been different and it's mm-hmm. been good. And this was a big part of them, these black ones. They're like, this organization does a great job of looking back to its history.
Yeah.
And what they really pushed with this one was looking ahead, which was kind of, I think that storytelling really did work with fans. And I think it's part of this excitement. It came at the right time with this new group of young players.
Mm-hmm.
Ellie De La Cruz, Matt McClain, who's unfortunately injured right now. But there was a new excitement last year. It was all kind of the perfect timing. And people were excited because it was an Ellie De La Cruz bobblehead, his first one. And his first one, mm-hmm. official Reds one. And I think that was a big part of it as well.
And like people lined up hours in advance, right?
Hours. And I know
and
people
ran out.
Yeah, they ran out hours before the game started.
Oh, wow.
And they had a certain amount. It was impressive. And you saw like just a mass of people. I know people who
they're like on eBay with them already, right?
Oh yeah. They were on eBay before the game started.
Oh,
like at 100, like the going price is probably the minimum is $100. If you get $100 you got a going price, if not more or less.
And are all of these, let's go back, you mentioned all the newbies, are they all living up to the hype?
No, because that's not how baseball works.
Mm.
You know, the hype is always going to be more than baseball because with baseball, you go in and you can go see Mike Trout 500 times, Shohei Ohtani, and you can go see him 5 times and they still only get hit 3 out of the 10 times, you know? So it's such a daily thing that I think it is a growing thing, a growing process to be there. They are not quite living up to the hype because the hype for Ellie De La Cruz is generational talent. And mm-hmm. he's not playing as a generational talent. That's not to say he won't in the future.
But he's only in a second season.
He's played 175 games in the big leagues, which sounds like a lot,
mm-hmm.
but when you play 162 a year, You think about Joey Votto playing thousands here, you know, it's different. So I don't think there's anything to say that he is not going to live up to that expectation. It's just not there yet.
All right. Yeah.
That makes sense, right?
I think so. Are people healthy? What's going on with that?
There have been a lot of injuries this year, starting with Matt McClain, who did not receive the hype of Ellie De La Cruz coming up last year, but was really one of the maybe the team's best player last year and a player that the team really was counting on. And he's been injured. He'll be out for most of the year. You had another young player, Noel V. Marte, who was suspended for violating the performance-enhancing drugs agreement, and he is now in Louisville. He is eligible to come back after 80 games, which is the end of this month. The 81st game of the year is June 27th in St. Louis.
And what exactly did he do?
He tested positive for a banned substance.
Oh. Okay.
A steroid.
Okay. And so, like, what exactly, other than an 80-game ban, like, what's the trajectory of that look like?
Well, you know, yeah, he gets an 80-game ban. He is now able to play in the minor leagues, and then they can bring him up whenever. If they did make the playoffs this year, he would not be able to play in the playoffs. Because of the suspension.
Oh, okay. And then... Is he the only one? Because he's
the
like a top
only one
prospect
suspended,
or something,
yes,
right?
Yes, he was probably their top one of their top position player prospect. And he started last year and he finished the year. He came up to the big leagues and played really well in his first bit. And so this was a player that they were really counting on. He is by trade a shortstop, but this team has stockpiled shortstops, which is good.
Okay.
Because pretty much every right-handed player in the big leagues was a shortstop at one point.
Right.
Because that's, you know, I never played shortstop. and not just because I was left-handed. But your best player growing up does. Most of these guys were their best players always.
All right.
Like Rose Lavelle was a little different than everybody she was playing with.
Right,
You know, in the leagues here. So it's that kind of thing. Long story short, they've had some really impactful injuries, but they're getting a status quo right now, and that's good.
All right. We've got about 30 seconds or so left. What are you watching for the rest of the season?
Over the rest of the season? I think Ellie De La Cruz and the continued development, so many of these young players, and the pitching has been great, and see if that continues to make those starting pitching strides.
All right. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you.
C. Trent Rosenkranz is senior baseball writer with The Athletic. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tana Weingartner. Lucy May returns next week. Thank you for listening. And please tell your pets I said hello.